You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Today, we are at the Giro d'Italia.
Cozze, cittadine, cozze, cozze, vicine. Non spiegateci ancora, non spiegateci ancora. Cozze, cittadine, cozze, cozze, vicine. Non spiegateci ancora, se non mangiano le femmine.
I don't know if you should be saying this, but teams, if you're out there, Dowsett, he is a top-level rider, so take him. Maybe also this team here will get a hold of him for next year, but he's free for contract.
Well, I said to myself already after half of the stage, if we come away and if we go with two guys to the finish line today, the victory will be for him. I have a contract for the next 2 years. He don't have a contract. And he's a rider I really appreciate. He helps me a lot in time trial things. He gives me a lot of tips. He's a really good teammate, and I think nobody deserves this victory more than him.
Who was that, Daniel?
Well, Rich, it was... Well, we had Nicky Sorensen first, didn't we?
We did.
Direct Sportif Israel Startup Nation.
Well done.
Not Cycling Academy. That was him, well, I suppose, sounding slightly mystified that the stage winner today in Vieste, Alex Dowsett, was starting today's stage, riding today's stage, winning today's stage without a contract for next year. And then we heard his breakaway companion, Dowsett's breakaway companion, Matthias Brendler from Austria, who was also really singing Dowsett's praises and saying that he was very much committed to Dowsett winning the stage today because Brendler's got a contract next year and Dowsett does not. So there's a bit of a theme of this.
It's curious. I would have thought Nicky Sorensen would be in a position of some influence in terms of him getting a new contract. And he did suggest that, you know, there might still be something at Israel Startup Nation, who are obviously stepping up next year. It reminded me a bit of, you know, a footballer in a club going for promotion, wins in promotion, and then gets edged out as they bring in more expensive players for the next season in the higher league. Not very fair to sort of draw a parallel there with Alex Dowsett, because he's a very established rider. It's the second Giro stage win today after time trial win in 2013.
Also very unlike you to draw a football parallel, or a football analogy.
Very unlike me. You know, I'm just trying to fit in, Daniel, with the majority in the podcast. You and Lionel like your football analogies. It's a curious one. I mean, I know that Israel Startup Nation sort of inherited him from Katusha. They took over the Katusha license. He was on a two-year contract with Katusha, and the second year was this year. So maybe that's something to do with it. I don't know. But certainly he made a theme of that, didn't he, in his post-race interviews. A come-and-get-me plea.
There'll be more of that, won't there, in a minute. But we should say, first of all, where we are.
Where are we, Daniel?
Well, Rich, I'm going to, again, flip the question.
Daniele Fibrincini, come stai?
So, bene, grazie, Riccardo Muresotto. And I'm going to flip the question around like I did yesterday. I'm testing you on your Italian regions.
I think we're still in Puglia.
We're still in Puglia.
Tonight. But we're heading out of Puglia tomorrow.
Towards the smallest region in Italy, which is called... You said there was a pizza...
Molise.
Correct.
Molise. It was a pizza in my local pizzeria in Tooting. That's how I remember, because it was my favourite pizza.
And specifically, Rich, today we were on a completely different part of Puglia, in a very different part of Puglia to the one that we saw yesterday. We stayed last night in one of the traditional conical Pugliese houses, the Trulli. And today we visited a part of Puglia that looks completely different, feels completely different. It's the Gargano Peninsula. And what did you make of it?
A national park, isn't it? Absolutely stunning. Very rugged and unpopulated. No buildings, no development at all there. Absolutely beautiful. We'll hear from our diarist, James Knox, later on, who was similarly blown away by the scenery. Beautiful beaches and beautiful views out over the Adriatic Sea.
Which is part of the Mediterranean.
Lovely little kind of outcrops. And it was just absolutely stunningly beautiful.
Puglia is known as, well, probably the flattest Italian region overall, because there are
really?
There's some very, very flat parts of Italy. So the Po Delta is incredibly flat in the north. But every region that has a bit of the Po Delta in it also has mountains. So Emilia-Romagna, Lombardy, Piedmont, and so forth and so on. Puglia is predominantly flat, but the Gargano is not flat at all, is it?
No.
It felt almost mountainous.
It did, and it was funny driving the course. We drove a lot of the course today, which was fortunate, actually, that it was considered a sprinter stage. It wasn't a sprinter stage, was it?
No, it wasn't. I should just say, to be more specific, Rich, now, currently we're on Lesina, which is a little town with a lake, and it's just on the kind of northern border of Puglia, and we're at a lovely Enoteca.
I was going to say, can you be in any more specific than that?
Well, we're in a lovely wine bar in Enoteca, but we're going to be a bit more specific about that later, aren't we? Because we might get a word with the owner.
Well, I mean,
about what we're drinking.
That one went down very well. Sorry, you're supposed to savour it, aren't you? I keep forgetting. Before we get on with tonight's podcast, just a quick call to action. On Monday, on the rest day, we're going to do a press conference. We weren't going to, but we are, because we quite enjoy them. Send your questions in with an audio file, please, to contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. If you can send us an audio file with you asking a question, get it in early enough and we might be able to put some of your questions to our audio diarist if you've got a question for one of them. If we don't get them to answer it for the press conference episode, we'll get them to answer it next week anyway. So any questions at all, please send them in. The big news that we woke up to this morning was about Simon Yates, who'd been below par, but it was confirmed by his team, Mitchell and Scott, this morning that he'd tested positive for COVID-19. It means he's out the race, obviously. The rest of his team were all tested and came back negative, so they're all still in the race. Simon Yates has been taken in an ambulance to Varese, where the team has a service course, and he'll quarantine there for 2 weeks. We'll talk about this a bit later in the podcast and what it means for the Giro, what it could mean for the Giro. And we'll have an interview with his team doctor, Matteo Beltamacchi. Well, we do the tale of the tapa. A lot of talk of Arnaud Démare going for three in a row today, but, well, when we drove the course, we realised that that was unlikely. It was very rugged, very up and down, 2,000 metres of climbing, so a tough day. And there was an early breakaway. Six riders got away. Alex Dowsett and Matthias Brendley from Israel Startup Nation were there. Matt Holmes was there from Lotto Soudal. Salvatore Puccio was there from Team Ineos Grenadiers. Joey Roscoff was there from CCC. And, of course, Simone Ravanelli was there from Androne Giocattoli.
I made a pronunciation faux pas yesterday because I referred to another, well, Simon of the same team, Gianni Savio's team. I called him Simon Peel. I always get confused with him because I think of him as Colombian now. He's Swiss, but he lives in Colombia. And consequently, I had a bit of a blackout in saying his name, but it's Simon Pelot. Thanks to Alain Rumpf. Alain Rumpf, who used to work for the UCI, who listens to the podcast, and he pulled me up on that.
Well, anyway, the breakaway was strong. You know, some good riders in there, and they got a big advantage 10 minutes before we knew it, really. Not a lot happened in the bunch. But with 80 kilometres to go, Jakob Fuglsang had a puncture on a descent. And at that point, Trek Segafredo had been apparently driving it, not really sure why. And they didn't let off once Fuglsang was in a bit of trouble. And at one point, he was a minute down as he chased to get back on. Bit of beef between Fuglsang and Nibali, perhaps.
Well, a bit of light, very dainty beef, a kind of carpaccio.
Like the beef we had last
night. Which could yet develop into a big old bistecca fiorentina.
He likes this, doesn't he, Nibali? Every time there's beef.
Well, a bit of background to that. I understand. Well, Fuglsang has been writing columns for the BT newspaper in Denmark, and he's been quite outspoken, quite honest, and quite candid. And either in his column or in an interview, he has talked about his relationship with Nibali. Of course, they were teammates at Astana. And Fuglsang said they used to get on pretty well. And he has the impression, or he has increasingly had the impression in recent times, that Nibali is a bit frosty with him, possibly because Fuglsang is now getting better results than was once the case. And Fuglsang is occasionally beating him in races and giving him quite a hard time. And there was, well, the finale of the Giro dell'Emilia a couple of months ago was sort of evidence of this. Well, Nibali seems to sort of mark Fuglsang while Vlasov, Fuglsang's teammate, was down the road. But there was maybe a little bit of tension there. So this could be brewing quite nicely. Another aside, maybe relevant aside to that, Fuglsang made some fairly unflattering remarks about Sicily, Nibali's native Sicily, in his column for BT, I think. And who knows, maybe that prodded the shark.
Yeah, I mean, that's it's funny, isn't it? I mean, it's like Sicily's famous for mafia, isn't it? And it's a sort of like mafia overtones
of this.
Hang on,
that's going too far. Well, if you make a generalisation, I'm allowed to make one then. Jakob Fuglsang is born in Switzerland, raised in Denmark, naturalised in Luxembourg and Monte Carlo. If ever someone is going to have grievances about the Sicilian litter and rubbish situation, then it's probably Jakob Fuglsang.
True. Well, listen, we had once that settled down and the carpaccio was devoured and polished off and put away, there wasn't an awful lot else that happened in the peloton. You know, more or less a day off for them. But up front, it was a really fascinating scenario to wonder how Israel were going to try and make their numerical advantage count, because it wasn't straightforward. It was a tough finishing circuit. They did two pretty tough climbs. And neither Dowsett nor Brendley are good climbers, really. They're strong riders, a great time trialist, both former hour record holders, of course, but not necessarily the strongest on the climb. So it was a bit of a puzzle that they had to solve. And Dowsett went first. He attacked with 30 kilometres to go. I wondered if Brendley was going to be able to, you know, play the good teammate there, because he looked in a little bit of trouble at times. Dowsett was caught. Puccio attacked. He got away with Holmes. Roscoff got across. And at that point, Brendley and Dowsett were both dropped and looked to be in a bit of trouble. And it's one of these situations where, you know, having had the numerical advantage and not making it count, that's always a bit of an awkward situation for a team. However, they sort of put their heads down, got back to the front group, and at 18 kilometres to go, Dowsett went again, and this time he went clear, and gap held for a little while, but then it stretched out, and you know, he had a comfortable lead at the start of the second time up the climb of about a minute. That was reduced as Puccio in particular was pretty strong behind, and Puccio was one of the only ones really chasing hard, it seemed. It did strike me watching it that the only chance they really had was to really drive it, really commit when they dropped the two Israel boys, because then it would have been every man for himself. It wouldn't have been complicated. As it was, when they were chasing Dowsett with Brendley there was that, he presented a danger. And so, yeah, Dowsett got away. He had enough of a lead over the climb. He could afford to, you know, ride up at his own pace up there. And in the end, he won by 1 minute 15 with Puccio, who's never won a professional race, winning the sprint for second. Matt Holmes was third.
Having turned pro late at 25 years of age, I think, or thereabouts, earlier this year, and won straight away. Won on Willunga Hill, mate, in the Tour Down Under, surprisingly, from a break, and then finished third today. And I spoke to him at the finish.
Well, Matt, I guess disappointment that you didn't bring it home, but you must be thrilled with the performance and to get third, I suppose.
Yeah, I'm almost glad I didn't win the sprint, because I would have really been kicking myself for letting Dowsett get away. But yeah, I was third, so I'm just happy for Dowsett, really, to win.
Talk about the moment when he did go, and I mean, he was gone pretty quickly, wasn't he?
Yeah, difficult when there's two of them. I just hoped that the other... Well, the stronger guys might control it, but he was so strong. Like, even in the last lap when we were going flat out, he rode away, got a bigger gap, so there's not much we can do.
When you won at the Tour Down Under earlier this year, you said that was, well, the biggest thrill of your career thus far. How did that compare today?
Pretty similar. I sort of spent all day thinking, oh God, how am I going to win this? How am I going to win this? And yeah, just a similar sort of day, really, but yeah, not quite as good. Try again, got two more weeks.
Well, that was Matt Holmes. Strong ride from him to be up there today. Actually, should we hear at this point from someone you spoke to this morning, Thomas De Gendt? This is a bit of a postscript to yesterday's stage. Harm van Hook, his teammate, who's riding high overall and in the white jersey for best young rider, although Joao Almeida actually has that, but van Hook's fourth overall. And he posted on Twitter yesterday, hands up if you've got good legs, with a picture of him holding his hand up. He then got stuck in the third echelon, and De Gendt, his own teammate, responded on Twitter saying, next time, bring those strong legs to the race. So you spoke to De Gendt this morning to find out what that was all about.
Thomas, you're standing next to Harm van Hooijdonk. Did you need to give him a lesson last night in not expressing his self-confidence on social media?
It was not the right moment to say that he had such good legs still before the day that he was really scared of. On paper, it looked like a really easy day, but it was one of the hardest already. He is lucky that he has a strong team, or he would be on 20 minutes yesterday. So I think he won't make the same mistake twice.
You had a bit of a laugh about it last night, though.
Yeah, sure. It was a joke, and it was just the right moment to make the joke. Adam!
Thomas again there, Rich. And I should point out that, well, we heard him there shouting Harm van Hook's name, screaming at him. He hadn't just tweeted again. He hadn't just done another self-aggrandizing tweet. It was, I think Eurosport wanted to speak to both of them, and Harm van Hook was slithering away.
I'll bet he was. I bet he felt a bit silly.
Talking of slithering, Rich, we're in Lesina. I mentioned this lake earlier, and the speciality here is eel. How do you feel about eel? I've never eaten eel before.
Never eaten eel.
And I'm not sure whether I'll have the courage to order it tonight.
Francois's a big fan of eels. He ate eels when we went somewhere where eels were a speciality. I can't remember where that was now. Just finally, and on the theme of animals, Daniel, the only thing that potentially could have been a banana skin for Alex Dowse today was in the finishing straight where a dog had entered the arena. There was a three-legged dog, and it was on the finishing straight for quite a long time. Dowsett gave it a wide berth because that would have been terrible if it had ran into him. We managed to catch up with the dog and get an exclusive interview. Here is the dog.
You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWocker. If you run a business, find out more at iWocker.co.uk. iWOCA.co.uk.
Thanks very much to our title sponsor, iWocker. We're grateful to them for their support, enabling us to be here at the Giro. And if you run a small business and you'd like to know more about how iWocker can help you, go to iwocker.co.uk, iwocker.co.uk. Well, Daniel, the story was all about Alex Dowsett today, wasn't it? His win 7 years after he won Stage 8 at the 2013 Giro, a time trial. Today was a road stage and he won it in very impressive fashion. Like I said, it was a puzzle that they had to kind of fix or sort out, and it wasn't straightforward.
I thought at one stage they'd dropped the jigsaw box and the pieces were all over the floor.
Well, so did I.
There was no way to pick them back up again.
Maybe they did too. As, like I say, that was the opportunity for the other guys, you know, to really commit and lose them and make their job a little bit simpler, because one against one is much easier than one against two.
Well, yes, Rich, and while the time trial win in 2013, so this is Alex Dowsett's second Grand Tour stage win, second Giro stage win, the one he won in 2013 was a long time trial. And while that, you know, possibly will have garnered more plaudits simply because of who he beat there and how unexpected it was, I think there'll be something especially satisfactory about, or satisfying about, the way, well, today it was sort of against the odds, really. I mean, he's not someone who, well, he gets into breaks like a lot of good rouleurs, but he's not someone who's done this frequently in his career. He's a very strong guy, but he's not a prolific winner, is he? Again, you know, maybe even more gratifying because at one stage it looked as though it had slipped through Israel Startup Nation's fingers. You know, the press conference was, well, it was pretty emotional, as were his interviews after the finish. He talks about the fact he hasn't got a contract for next year. He's got a baby on the way. It's slightly mystifying why he's not been picked up, but I think he deserves credit in his career for sort of existing outside of the bubble of, well, the de facto national team and national structure, which has been Sky Ineos. He did ride for Sky for, was it 2 years? But otherwise, he's had to ply his trade in various different types of different environments, different roles. He's been at Movistar, he's been at Katusha, he's now at Israel. And, you know, at times I think that's not been easy, and he hasn't been on a meal ticket.
Not at all. I mean, as you say, he's a strong rider, and it is slightly mystifying. Okay, these are unusual times, and there's a lot of uncertainty around several teams at the moment, and I imagine there's there are lots of other riders in his position, some of whom we probably don't even know about. You know, he had that platform today. It was a great opportunity for him to make his case, you know, not only in the stage, but after the stage as well. But, you know, he's a strong rider. He's a very experienced rider now, and he's a strong time trialist, and he's always had a great interest in equipment and position and all these things. He's always been maybe ahead of the curve there.
Well, he certainly was at one point, and he thought that he was ahead of the curve, certainly probably in the first half of the last decade. But I spoke to him, was it last year or the year before, the Dauphiné, about time trialing and about how he felt he'd taken his eye off the ball as far as equipment was concerned. Yes, he's a powerful ruler and he's got a lot of watts, but he felt that some of his advantage used to come from the fact that he was a much more diligent student of aerodynamics and equipment than a lot of the guys he was up against. And he's felt as though in the last 2 or 3 years people have caught up.
He posted something fascinating on the eve of the Giro, actually, himself winning the time trial in 2013. And he sort of pointed out all the faults and the flaws in his position and equipment and so on. He actually featured in our Giro, didn't he, which we did when the Giro should have been on. We looked back at that win in 2013 with him, and he spoke about the day and how how shambolic it was. In a way, he was riding for Movistar at the time. It was his first year with them. He hadn't wrecked the course or anything. It was a surprising win then, but looking at his position and his bike and his equipment choices at the time, it was the best of what was available then. But he said he wouldn't have a chance of being competitive in a time trial now with that kind of setup. And that was only 7 years ago. It shows you how much things have moved on since then.
The other angle to this, Rich, is of course what it means to Israel Startup Nation. I mean, they had quite a rough Tour de France. It was their first tour that they started with the kind of mission, or they started this season with a mission really to win a stage in any Grand Tour. I think it's well documented that Sylvain Adams, the Israeli-Canadian entrepreneur behind that team, he wants to take the team to the top. He's got a lot of money, he's invested in Chris Froome. But you watched their performance in the Tour de France and you thought this team is still a long way off. I suspected they'd be doubly happy and jubilant tonight because of, you know, how rough the tour had been in some ways. And I asked Nicky Sorensen, the team's director sportif, about that at the finish, and also Matthias Brändli about exactly how the win had come together.
In the first meeting of with the team this year, the goal was to win a world tour race. Today we did it. I think we did history. I'm really proud to be part of this project, also to be today there in the breakaway. And I think it was also Saturday where a lot of people saw it on television, and it was really, really cool to be out there and to finally finish off like this. We knew in the climb maybe the other guys will be stronger, so we have to go before the climb. We tried it a bit before the first time when we arrived on the finish line, but then we didn't come away. We got dropped both on the climb. Alex waited me maybe 5 seconds on the top of the climb. We chased back like in a team time trial. And then we said, okay, let's keep attacking. And then all of a sudden, Alex had a gap. I controlled the guys behind, and so his gap was growing, growing, growing. And then I think he had like 40 seconds for the last climb. And the top was 20, and then when he had 20, I know he will bring it to the finish line.
Nicky, we saw Sylvain Adams riding around at the Tour de France, and, has he been on the phone already?
Well, I haven't. I just went around talking to all the staff members, but I sent a text to Sylvain during the race and saying we have a good chance. I knew early on that we had a good chance for this victory with those two guys up in front. He's been following for sure.
I know it's hard to put into words, but what does this mean for the team after this very difficult year for everyone?
It means a lot. We have to find ourselves in world tour level. We are really, can you say, upgrading really fast in terms of riders, so it's important that the whole structure of the team follows that, and right now we're showing that we're going the right direction. We want to be ready for when Chris Froome is coming to this team, and this is very important for them.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. You can get 25% off all your Science and Sport products with the discount code SISCP25. Daniel, SISCP25 at the website scienceandsport.com. Thank you to Science and Sport for their continuing support of the Cycling Podcast. Now, Daniel, as I said earlier, we woke up to the news this morning that Simon Yates had tested positive for COVID-19. First rider in a Grand Tour. There have been riders in other races who've tested positive for COVID-19. Simon Yates is the first one in a Grand Tour, and a very high-profile one at that. You know, came in as one of the favourites, maybe even the favourite for the race. And his performances haven't been great. Lots of people, you know, jumping to conclusions about whether this is an explanation for that. Who knows? He started to feel unwell last night, we are told, and, you know, had a headache and you know, symptoms that might suggest coronavirus, had a test, and it came back positive. And I said, everyone else on Mitchell & Scott was tested.
We'll be tested again tonight and tomorrow.
Brent Bookwalter, the Mitchell & Scott rider who's out the race now, injured, did give an interview a few days ago where he was expressing some kind of uneasiness at the measures in place, and especially the risks that he felt they were exposed to in hotels and so on, where I don't think things are as rigidly applied here as they were at the Tour de France. The bubble is not as impermeable as it was at the Tour de France. There's a lot more potential contact between riders and the outside world, from hotels to even at starts as well, where they often ride through the public to get to the start. I saw Peter Sagan having a selfie today with a fan who had his arm around him as they rode to the start. So it's definitely not the same as the Tour de France. And who knows how Yates picked this up. There will be tests on Monday of everybody on the rest day. And I guess we're bracing ourselves for maybe more positive tests. Well, we'll hear from the doctor at Mitchell & Scott, Matteo Beltamacchi. Is that his name? He's an Italian chap who is the team doctor at Mitchell & Scott. And he came and spoke to you and others this morning, Daniel.
You know, Simon was tested positive yesterday night to COVID. The test was done just for a very precaution, because he never complained any symptoms since the start of the Giro. Also, according with the UCI protocol, and also according our team protocol is more also tight, we control him with temperature, with a lot of way of monitoring. He always be fine. So after the stage yesterday, he complained a little bit headache, and I checked the temperature, was 37.4, so less than the red flag. But maybe because I'm like this, maybe because it's Simon, I prefer as precaution also to keep the guys very quiet, to do a rapid test, because thanks to RGS we can have this test that works very well. So I just try to put the rider in that condition to say, you are safe, don't worry. By the end, the bad news is it was positive. I think that till the start of the season, not till the start of the Giro, after COVID, we all know the risk, staff, rider. So we are very proud to fight against this problem, also because our bubble, our internal bubble, I'm pretty sure, was a perfect bubble. I answer you like a doctor that works in this circuit, okay? It's completely safe, because we've been tested now for 3 days. All the guys, all the staff, yesterday, they already been tested. Everyone is negative. Every guy is without any symptom. They are strong, confident to race, even if the situation is not easy. And so we go ahead with the confidence.
I mean, Rich, I talked about the bubble not being as robust as it was at the Tour de France. There are far fewer people around the race. Today was obviously on the weekend, the Saturday, and we went to some relatively built-up areas. Certainly the start in Giovinazzo was, it's a suburb of Bari, which is a big city. So there were quite a lot of people there, but generally speaking, the crowds have been very sparse by Giro standards, which presumably makes things a bit safer. But certainly, as I said earlier, you know, the fans are able to get pretty good access, get pretty close to the riders. That's the concern. I guess, you know, now we're sort of waiting with bated breath for the results of the Mitchelton Scott tests, or you know, to find out whether they've had any more positives, and not a lot more anyone can do really, apart from wait, is there?
Well, Simon Yates wasn't the only non-starter today. Sean Bennett, EF Pro Cycling, Eduardo Affini of Mitchell & Scott. He crashed yesterday. We mentioned that he might not be a star today. Patrick Gamper, who's been a very important helper for Peter Sagan, Bora Hansgrohe, and Tony Gallopin, who had a nasty crash yesterday. And his AG2R teammate Ben Gastauer crashed today and didn't finish the stage. So quite a few riders lost over this weekend. And a big day tomorrow, isn't it, Daniel, for GC?
Well, Rich, we're heading into the mountains tomorrow, aren't we? Albeit briefly, to Roccarazzo, known to Italians as a town in the Abruzzo Mountains that was heavily bombed by the Allies in 1943. It was one of the sort of last stands of the Nazis in Italy, and it was pretty much flattened by the Allies, and it's, you know, synonymous with the Second World War. As far as cycling is concerned, I think it's going to be the eighth or ninth time the Giro has been there. It's not the hardest climb, but the whole day is very, very lumpy indeed. I suppose you'd call it medium mountain. But, you know, we've said many times already in this Giro that it's going to be a strange old race, and anything could happen, really. Especially with the way the second week is looking. It's a kind of a unusual second week. There are a couple of stages that look fairly straightforward on paper, but there's a stage, for example, to Tortoreto Lido, which could really be a Tirreno Adriatico stage. Lots of short, very, very steep climbs. Also with the prospect of the Alpine stages later in the race being cut or truncated. Who knows? We might, you know, on stages like tomorrow, see more action than we had bargained for.
Who will be in the pink jersey tomorrow night?
I think João Almeida will still be in the pink jersey.
You do. He's got 43 seconds over Pau Bilbao, first of the GC men, I suppose. Then Wilco Kelderman, Harm van Hook, Vincenzo Nibali, Domenico Pozzovivo, Jakob Fuglsang, Stephen Kruijswijk. I mean, those are the main guys. I guess the only other one, maybe Rafał Majka, who we'd talk about as a you know, contender. But Bilbao is very well placed, isn't he, if Almeida does falter. And somebody who's just arrived at the Giro is Rod Ellingworth, the boss at Bahrain McLaren.
Rod, week into the Giro, you've had some success with Pau Bilbao already. How would you assess the first week?
Good, yeah. We just had a meeting. Obviously, I've come in last night, and for the team, where we are in this part of the season, everything that's going off at the moment, you know, just sort of addressed that with the guys on the bus to say, yeah, the team who's going to win here is a team who stays strong mentally, because everybody, even though they haven't done many days of racing, I think there's a mental fatigue with this season in terms of people just feeling a little bit sort of like it's long. Normally it's because they've done the whole season, but it just feels very strange, doesn't it? You know, so I said to them, that's the team who's going to win here. And I think we've got a good group, you know. And also the other thing is, not many of these guys have raced much together, so every day they're only going to get better, I think, you know. So there's a bit of work to do, obviously, with some of them, but that's the challenge. I think Peo's feeling really good. We came in here with a real open attitude for him. Come here, we appreciate he's done the tour. It's a hard turnaround, so we're just taking it day by day, you know. But his first objective is to try and stay on GC and try and win the bike race if he can. We are giving him that freedom a little bit off, because I know his attitude, he'll want to push every day. So,
because I spoke to him a few days ago, Rod, and he said that he can't rule out the form just disappearing. I mean, not disappearing, but yeah, having a very bad day. Yeah. But on the other hand, he has the precedent of a couple of years ago, he did the Giro, then the Dauphiné, and he was great at the Dauphiné, and he won stages. But are you pretty confident that it won't just desert him over the next week or two?
I mean, I don't know Pau too well. Obviously, I only just started working with him. I'm listening to what he's saying to me. Again, due to the unusual season, who knows what the hell's going to happen. But I do believe, you know, there's one thing about people's commitments and attitude, and his attitude is absolutely world class. He's 10 out of 10. If he does come off GC, it won't be for the sake of just giving up. It'll be because he's sort of mentally burnt out or something. But I think at the moment he's really enjoying it. He said to me he's really enjoying the group and enjoying the race.
You said you just had a chat to them on the bus. Presumably, you might have touched on what's happened with Simon Yates this morning and just the sort of cloud that maybe throws over the whole race. Have you got any particular concerns that maybe you didn't have at the Tour de France?
Well, I think you just look around the world, isn't it? Everywhere's shutting down again. Everywhere's sort of changing and going back. So, you know, I think everybody's talking about, will it get to the finish, but who knows? I think we can only concentrate on what we're doing. I didn't talk to the guys about the Simon Yates issue particularly. There's the what was flying around this morning, but you know, it's obviously quite a critical moment for a team to pull a rider like him at this time. So I think, again, that's where you just got to look at yourselves and think about your day-to-day routines. I've been really happy so far with what the team have done and how we've dealt with the COVID situation. And we, you know, within our own, keeping our own bubble, and how we've managed that is obviously the UCI regulations. And we've also got tight regulations. You know, we're really keeping on top of it. So like most, it's pretty hard luck to get that, bad luck to have that situation, yeah. I mean, hopefully we'll make it, won't we? But who knows? It's just a crazy time, isn't it?
So that was Rod Ellingworth. He's a fan of Peyo Bilbao, isn't he, Daniel?
Well, he's rich, and Peyo Bilbao fits the sort of Rod Ellingworth profile. He seems to be someone who never complains, who's a very serious professional, consummate professional. And interesting to hear Rod talk there quite bluntly, I suppose, about winning the Giro. And, you know, I think that reflects a feeling among several, what you would, prior to the race, have called second or third tier contenders. I think they're looking around, and that there's no one really that, you know, the likes of Peyo Bilbao or Domenico Pozzovivo haven't beaten in the past at some point.
Don't discount Wilco, man.
Well, exactly. Apart from Nibali, it's very, very difficult to identify an outstanding candidate for victory.
When you say winner from Barney McLaren, presumably you're talking about your man, Herman Pernsteiner. He's your kind of dark horse, isn't he?
I'm telling you.
He's going to win it.
Well, he's not going to win it. He's not going to win it.
Backtracking,
but he might finish in the top 10 and surprise some people.
Well, listen, João Almeida is still in a very strong position and hasn't really been tested yet. He will be tomorrow, and he may well be up to that. Let's hear from his teammate at De Koenig Quickstep, James Knox, who's keeping an audio diary for us.
Stage 8 done. Yeah, another long one today, over 200k. In the end, quite straightforward. I think we did a pretty good job. Pretty mad first 30 kilometres. Six strong guys got away, and we sort of managed to block the road a little bit, and we helped some of the guys who had teammates up the road close the road off a little bit. As it is, were the two teams really trying to desperately close it. But yeah, like I said, strong guys in front, so they pulled out the advantage, and that was it, really. We were happy to let it go, and yeah, it did go, I think, 14 minutes on the line. So in the end, relatively straightforward on what could have been a complicated day. We had some hard roads after 100 kilometres. We had a pretty difficult climb to get us going, twisty descent where Trek lit it up under rather interesting circumstances. They were already going, but they definitely didn't slow down when a little buzz in the radio of punches and crash behind. That was probably the biggest talking point of the day, I guess, from behind. And then, yeah, what a beautiful, beautiful place we were riding in. I feel like I've always had a bit of a passion, don't know why, for geography, maps, stuff like this, but never really heard of Gargano, the natural park there. We did have a finish last year in San Giovanni Rotunda, where teammate Faso Masnada won last year for Androni, which was very nearby, but I don't remember that being nice. But today was absolutely beautiful. Really, really nice roads. Did have a chance to take it in. A lot of olive groves and white villages, white stones and lovely beaches and cliffs. Saw like a really nice cliff arch. Did do A-level geography, but I can't remember if it's just called an arch or like a cliff with a hole in a minute in the middle of it, on its way to becoming a stack, if my A-level geography is correct. But yeah, it was lovely. Would recommend for a holiday. Go there. Shows how interesting the racing was today, that I was thinking about going there for holiday. But yeah, Giro's starting to take its toll, if I'm being honest. Transfers, long days, transfers. We had an hour in the car this morning. 5.5 hours on the bike, I think. Almost a couple of hours back in the... We had to go take the cars because the bus was too long after the stage. And yeah, just starting to... Maybe after the stress of yesterday, I've been super excited and revved up for it. And then today, not really... Yeah, just having to turn the pedals over, if I'm being honest. You know, grind it out, get it done. Get it done and ticked off. And British victory. Mixed emotion for the Brits, of course. We had Simon Yates out, but Dowsett taking the wins. Yeah, that's the way she goes.
That was James Knox of De Koenig Quickstep, teammate of the pink jersey João Almeida. And, well, James was blown away. They had perhaps, I don't think it's unkind to say that in the bunch, they probably had a bit more time than usual to look around and appreciate the scenery. And he seems to have appreciated the scenery today.
Yes, Rich. Well, it was always going to be a big theme of this Giro, wasn't it? Italy showing itself off again to the world and also to the Italians as a major tourist destination. I mean, tourism in Italy is worth 25.6 billion euros a year.
That's 6% of the GDP of Italy, 283,000 people working in tourism in Italy. So it's enormous, and it's obviously been hit very badly by the COVID pandemic. Yesterday, Rich, yesterday, I dropped this name yesterday, I teased it yesterday. I spoke to the director of tourism for the whole of Italy, Giovanni Bastianelli, about, well, we've been blown away by Puglia, and we were in Basilicata yesterday. We spoke a little bit about that, but we also spoke a bit about the role the Giro could play, and the, believe it or not, the Giro E, the electric Giro, is that what we're going to call it? Electronic Giro, motorized Giro, which we haven't spoken much about so far in the podcast.
But at all.
Well, did we mention the fact that Gilberto Simoni is riding?
I'm not sure we did.
And Moreno Moser. Anyway, we might well touch on that in the coming days. But the Italian National Tourist Board is investing in the Giro. It's investing in the Giro E. And Giovanni Bastianelli told me why yesterday.
Qui siamo in una regione, la Puglia, dove è un'eccellenza che abbiamo nel sud come turismo.
We're in a region, Puglia, which is a real benchmark for tourism in the south of Italy. Today we started from Matera, which also benefited hugely from being the European capital of culture last year. But generally the kind of tourism that's really developing is one that suits the south of Italy perfectly. It also suits young entrepreneurs who want to create something. Sustainability is becoming vitally important, our relationship with nature, and there's an opening for what I now call slow tourism, which the south of Italy is perfect for. So the big advantage is the climate at this time of year. Now is when the gap between the temperatures and weather in the north and south of Europe is at its widest. So basically, the Giro is helping to show that you can have a summer-type holiday even in November sometimes, which is key for attracting people to the south, as I said. Of course, business and entrepreneurship are important, but so are quality agriculture and food and wine in the contribution they can make to lifting these areas back up. We've obviously had to focus a lot this year on persuading Italians to go on holiday in Italy, but my message to foreigners wanting to spend their holidays here is that they can. But we have to think about one thing. We have to figure out which habits and behaviours this pandemic has changed. Because it's clear that we won't just go back to how we were. Probably never. So let's turn it into a positive. Recognise that having a holiday in nature with more space and peace, thinking about sustainability, is a good thing. Our habits are also already starting to change and reflect that. This is the slow tourism I was talking about. It's also why we're investing heavily in the Giro d'Italia and the Giro E, because as well as the sustainability of electric bikes, they also make active holidays accessible to people who aren't quite as fit as the riders here. And it makes places, summits and views accessible that are unique in the world. This is why we're tightening our links with the Giro, because we want to work less on volume and more on quality and value.
Well, Rich, we've enjoyed our time in Puglia and we're enjoying our time in Italy. Before we go, we should mention, I touched on it earlier, the lovely wine we've been drinking at the, the lovely Enoteca in Lesina and the Valle del Lecce, which is a wine producer just outside Lesina, and they've got a nice Enoteca here. And we've been joined by the winemaker.
What do you know?
Manuel, we've tasted your lovely Essenziale Nero di Troia, in English, Black of Troy, 2017. Tell us a little bit about this wine.
Nero di Troia is a native variety of Foggia area. We produce Nero di Troia in oak, so Nero di Troia is in oak for 2 years, and after in bottle for 6 months. And after 6 months in bottle, we can sell this wine. You can taste the sweetness, and also the tannins there also are most important in this wine.
And Manuel, we know from Puglia, we know Negro Amaro, Primitivo, Nero di Troia is not as well known outside of Italy. Why?
Nero di Troia is not most famous. Primitivo and Negro Amaro is most famous, but is a variety, native variety of Salento. So Salento increase the...
Salento is the south of Puglia. Yes. It's where Rich and Maraterra, who make our music for the podcast,
yes,
are from.
Yes, so Salento increase themselves, and increase also Primitivo and Negro Amaro. Foggia, Gargano is not most famous, so Bombino, Nero di Troia is not for me most famous too.
Well, we've certainly enjoyed it, haven't we, Rich?
Very nice.
He's Daniel, very nice.
There
friend.
Are actually three bottles lined up here. There's a white wine, a rosé, and a red wine. Are these all your wines?
Yes, these are all my wines. I mean, Bombino Bianco is white wine, and Nero di Troia rosé and black wine.
Three of my favorite wines, Daniel, white, rosé, and red.
All from the Valle dell'Elche, the winery, and the lovely Enoteca in Lesina. Rich will might be having a little bit more wine later, won't we?
Oh, yeah,
I've already
certainly.
Said no to the eel. Manuel and Manuel's mother, Maria, have suggested that we have the eel, the famous eel from Lesina.
From the lake here.
From the lake. I think they could see from my facial expression that I wasn't too enthusiastic about that. So I think it's going to be...
Well, you're not a big sea...
No.
I mean, you don't like fish generally,
not
do
really,
you?
Not really.
What wine would you have with the eel?
Anguilla, the Lesina tradition. Say that with anguilla or capitone, with a red wine, but cold red wine, not hot red wine.
That's, well, we're used to that with Francois. He's a big fan of the chilled red wine with seafood at the Tour de France. So not promising that I'll have the eel, but I'll consider it.
Well, thank you, Manuel, and grazie, Maria. And, tomorrow, Rich, we're going to Abruzzo. We'll be in Roccaraso tomorrow night. So drinking something different, maybe Montepulciano and Abruzzo.
Grazie mille, Daniele Fibroncini.
Grazie.